What will Donald Trump's priorities on the world stage look like if he returns to the White House next January? One of the most impactful jobs shaping a president's approach to the outside world is National Security Advisor. The holder can sway American foreign and security footprint, a role famously filled by Henry Kissinger in the 1970s. Someone with a connection to the Trump and Nixon eras is my guest on Power Play this week. He's the grandson of William Colby, the controversial director of the CIA between 1973 and 76. Elbridge Colby is a hot tip to be the next national security advisor in a possible new Trump administration. Welcome to Power Play from Politico, where we talk to some of the world's most influential people on both sides of the Atlantic. I'm your host, Anne McElvoy. My guest served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development in Donald Trump's first term in office. Since then, he's co-founded the Marathon Initiative, a conservative think tank intensely focused on how America deals with an increasingly assertive China, a subject testing both Democrats and Republicans. Elbridge Colby, welcome to Power Play.
Great to be with you.
You served in the first Trump administration at the Pentagon. You were highly influential then in shaping the national defense strategy. That was back in 2018, arguing strongly for a tilt to the Pacific, confronting a more assertive China. 6 years on, do you still think that Donald Trump's team would consider this as the principal threat and therefore the principal focus of what would be a likely tilt again in foreign policy if there were, in fact, a change of power in the White House?
Well, what I would say is that I'm, you know, very careful not to pretend to be representing President Trump, and that the campaign is very clear that only he and they speak for him in the campaign. And they said, actually, I believe today in early May, or may have been yesterday, that China would be the focus. And you've seen President Trump himself say that. So, again, I can't speak for him. What I would say is that the strategic reality, China has continued to grow in military power, its aggressiveness. It's not changing its support for Ukraine or North Korea, et cetera. And the most important thing is that whoever is elected president in November, and I hope it's President Trump, but even if it's President Biden, 2027 is going to be in that presidential term. By the way, 67% of Republicans believe that China is our top threat. It's followed in distant second by Iran. So I think where Republican voters are is going to be focused, and I think they're right, on China.
We have introduced you to our audience saying that you'd potentially be a very credible pick for National Security Advisor. Is that a job that you would like?
Well, I again, let me stress, I don't make any representation or prediction about my own role. I would be honored to serve in a Trump administration, especially at this very difficult time. Candidly, I am deeply conscious of the gravity of the situation. So, you know, whether it's me or somebody else, I think whoever goes into the government, you know, and hopefully in a Trump administration, they need to look at the problem with real clarity. And that is what the American people and our allies deserve, because we are heading towards the iceberg and we are now at best going to barely miss it. And I think there's a very real chance we'll hit it. So we are in a very, very dangerous situation. What I'll say...
What is that iceberg? Tell me about the iceberg.
I think that iceberg is, you could define it in different ways. I sometimes leave it a little ambiguous, but I think the iceberg is a war with China or a collapse of our position in Asia because we're not prepared for a war in China and China challenges us. So, you know, I don't pretend to know what's in Xi Jinping's head. I don't take particularly seriously on this issue anybody who does say they know what Xi Jinping will do. All that we know, or not all, what we do know is that he's avidly and actively preparing the Chinese military to be ready, and they're making progress. And he's preparing the Chinese economy and society for confrontation with the United States, and that he's not persuaded that we don't seek to challenge. And in fact, the word he uses is strangle China. So unfortunately, the thing about getting prepared for the only thing that's going to deter China, in my view, reliably, is military force relevant to the first island chain in Asia. And that's not what we're doing.
I'm going to dig into that in just a minute, but I must pause to reflect that statecraft and indeed this focus on the role of China and its interrelation with the U.S. runs to an extent in your blood. Your grandfather, William Colby, was director of the CIA in the early 70s, catching the end of that Nixon era. The famous phrase then, only Nixon could go to China, which has gone into, well, it's gone into everything really, hasn't it? It's gone into statecraft, it's gone into every diplomatic textbook, it's even gone into opera. That represents a really different perspective, bringing Beijing in from the cold, ushering in an era of trading and diplomatic relations. It was then, of course, with Peking, now we would say Beijing. Do you not look back at that time and also see a potential model for American leadership?
Well, let me just say about my grandfather, I don't claim any special credibility or authority based on it for those who admired him and for those who hated him. And there were many. I also don't, you know, give me an open hearing. So my arguments can be judged on their merits, no matter who my grandfather was.
I am. I'm just fascinated by that family connection. And frankly, also, you know, having authored books about intelligence in the Cold War, of course, I got a bit of a frisson when I saw your second name.
One thing I probably do have is the ability to annoy a fair amount of the Washington establishment. That's one thing that has passed down in it from his legacy. Well, actually, I would say that President Trump's approach is actually more akin to what President Nixon tapping into a long legacy of Republicans, particularly President Eisenhower, pursued. And then even in the Reagan administration of people like Jim Baker, which was, I would say, a more hard-nosed kind of business-like pragmatic approach. You know, the world has changed from when I actually thought President Nixon's opening to China was a good move in the context of the Cold War. It was designed to open a multi-front problem for the Soviet Union at the perceived apogee of their power. So I think, and by the way, President Trump, I think rightly has maintained his openness to talk to Xi Jinping and to Beijing's leadership and not to push them into a corner. He's not pursuing, or he's not talking about a kind of existential cage match idea that some Republicans engage in. I think President Trump has rightly kept open. And in fact, you know, it was an important part of President Nixon's policy to pursue engagement with the Soviet Union. And that, in fact, President Reagan, I agree with President Reagan's military buildup in the early 80s, but bear in mind that President Reagan also used that to engage with Mikhail Gorbachev. So I think that keeping, you know, as Jim Baker, I think, once said, you know, it's one thing, it's easy to talk to your friends. It's really important to talk to your enemies. So I think, but we need to do that not in the way the Democrats tend to do, which is hoping to kind of come to some understanding. No, it's hard-nosed. It's directly delivering the message, et cetera.
Let me press you then on the options the new administration would face when it comes to the tensions and priorities that would be on the to-do list. You have the war in Ukraine, how to deal with Vladimir Putin, who, if anything, is becoming more hardline. The cruelty, I think, of what is happening in Ukraine is not lost on any of us. I spoke a few weeks ago to Robert Greenway, who, as you know, worked on the National Security Council. He said the US has to enforce sanctions and expand them to entities that matter. We haven't taken a serious approach. Do you agree on that point on sanctions?
Well, Rob is a good friend. I would say I am increasingly convinced of the inutility of sanctions, especially against major powers like Russia and certainly China. So I am actually moving in the other direction. I think the most important thing for the Ukrainians and the war effort in Europe is actually providing the Ukrainians with military support and weapons. The problem is that the United States does not have the resources, either militarily or financially, to play the leading role, and that's why it needs to be Europe. I think the sanctions have manifestly failed against Russia. And I think the reason, I mean, in fairness to the Biden administration, it's hard to imagine a more cohesive and broader sanctions campaign. It's in the nature of sanctions, though, that if we keep pushing it, we are going to alienate a lot of countries, and there's too much money to be made. So, I mean, I just don't think sanctions are a very effective tool. I think against a country like Iran, they can be more effective. So I support firmer sanctions against Iran. I'm not sort of morally opposed to sanctions on Russia. To the contrary, I just don't think they're very effective. And it's dangerous if we think that they're going to achieve something which they're not.
Let's look at the effectiveness or otherwise of that big package, the $61 billion package, finally made its way through Congress, military aid to Ukraine, sorely needed, urgently needed at the front line. But this week you said you agreed with Republican critics of the aid package in the House, principally Mike Garcia, who said that he was unclear whether the aim was total victory over Russia in Ukraine or simply buying time to the negotiating table. Lack of clarity. Is that your view?
Well, I think the supplemental was a mistake in the sense that it was most fundamentally its priorities were wholly out of whack. I mean, we know that we're behind on China. So the RAND corporations assessed last summer that we are heading towards a defeat in a war over Taiwan. That's the most respected national security think tank, kind of close to the government in the country, possibly in the world. And Admiral Sampaporo, the new PACOM commander, said in the New York Times, in a piece by Ed Wong, it was a very good piece, rightly acknowledging many of the good things that are happening in this administration in Asia, saying that we're not keeping track with the Chinese military, which is ultimately all that matters, because to quote Top Gun, there's no points for second place. So as Mike Gallagher, I'm not sure he's followed through on the logic of his position, but I think he was correct to say the support for Taiwan and by extension in Asia in the bill was a joke. That's the phrase that I believe Mike used a few months ago. I supported Congressman Garcia's position and the speaker's position that this was out of whack in a number of ways and that it needed to have some plausible also, you know, public strategy, not like some very boutique or baroque kind of particular way. But I mean, immediately after the supplemental passed, there was a story in Politico about the administration and others, you know, leaking out that they're not sure that this is going to make that much of a difference or that it's not going to lead towards and not forget victory. I don't think victory in terms of like, you know, 1945. That's not in the cards, but even like a plausible, you know, really positive outcome. So my objection to the supplemental is not that it supports Ukraine. I also think we collectively should support Ukraine. I'm just dealing with the very clear reality, which is that we have scarcity. We have scarcity in our military forces. They ain't what it used to be. Our defense industrial base, our money. Senator McConnell said it was not $170 billion, not a lot of money. Of course, it's a lot of money, right? I mean, of course, people think it's a lot of money and political will. People are tired of the forever wars. Of course, Ukraine is not direct American intervention, although some people would probably push in that direction. But it's a lot of money, and we're engaged in another conflict like this. Just the last thought is that we should first prioritize China in particular, and that holds for the Middle East as well, and then provide the Ukrainians with things in our stockpiles that genuinely don't have anything to do with a China and Taiwan fight. And then really shift the burden onto the Europeans and make it very clear to them. And that's what President Trump has been saying and doing. And it's taken too long, but we're finally gaining momentum. I fear the supplemental may have taken the wind out of the sails a little bit on that. But clearly, that's the direction we're heading.
So the message really is over to you, Europe.
Yes.
We don't want to do much more.
Well, want is not material. So anybody, you know, people are saying, oh, we're going to walk and chew gum or we're America. We can do anything. They're living in a you know, Top Gun. They're living in a Ronald Reagan dreamscape. It's not, you know, as I think Robert F. Kennedy put it quite well. He said, it's not 1961 anymore. It's not 1981. We have 100% debt to GDP ratio. Reagan had like 30%, much younger demographics, much different political situation in the country. And we know the military is not capable. The military in 1980 had actually the Cold War buildup, not to mention even forces from World War II. We don't have that. And frankly, many of the people who are talking that way were responsible for getting us in the Middle East wars, where we blew trillions of dollars and the readiness of our military on peripheral conflicts. China called that the period of strategic opportunity.
So I'm presuming you would disagree with my guest on Power Play last week, who was the British ambassador to the US, Dame Karen Pierce. She said this: the central message is going to give Ukraine a huge psychological boost, that America is behind her, Congress is behind her, and our will to support Ukraine is undimmed in pushing back President Putin's ambitions. What do you make of her view?
Well, I disagree with the ambassador, and I disagree with what I understand to be the British position, certainly from David Cameron, who, you know, finds every opportunity to come and moralize to the Americans after he was responsible for cutting the British military and, you know, the panda hug of China in the early 2010s. So it's really the height of audacity for such a person to be coming and lecturing us. But I think that's a misread of the situation. And there's this idea that I actually don't understand the political strategy of those from the old days, the kind of neo-Reaganite. I separate the neo-Reaganites from Reagan himself, who is a much more, I think there's much more nuance there. But the neo-Reaganites seem to think they're just going to like stuff and marginalize the majority of the Republican voters and even a majority of Republican votes in the House. I actually think that political strategy is more likely to get us to real restraint, because people are so suspicious and opposed to the national security establishment, frankly, with a decent justification, and the political establishment, that they're going to say, forget it. And that's a dangerous place. Better to let air out of the balloon, you know, in a moderate way.
As some may have noticed by my accent, I am indeed a true Brit. And I'm very interested in what you just said there about the British position on Ukraine, or indeed the British position on the transatlantic relationship through the defence and security foreign policy prism that we're discussing today. You do seem to think, I mean, just flesh that out for me a bit more. You do seem to think that we've got it wrong, right? Not just David Cameron, perhaps, but the Rishi Sunak government, by implication, also the Tony Blair era, how Britain gets involved in these conflicts, and judging Ukraine as, if you like, the great moral and ethical test, which I think is a fair description of how the UK government sees it. What are we getting wrong?
Yeah, you just need a lot more realism in the UK government. I find the gap between British conservatives and American conservatives must be at an all-time high. I mean, maybe going back to, like, I don't know, 1812 or something. But, I mean, it's just a very wide gap, because the beating heart and the ascendant part of the Republican Party is in the sort of realism and restraint kind of prioritizer side of the spectrum. And British conservatives make, I to use the term, I think they're almost exclusively neoconservatives. You know, everything is like the children of light and the children of darkness, kind of Manichaean stuff, totally unsupported by an actual military or fiscal capability to support it. So Rishi Sunak comes out with this absurd pledge when every indication is that the Tories are going down to historic defeat about the future. It was like, well, didn't Boris Johnson make a 3% pledge like 5 minutes ago? And Liz Truss had a different. So it's like, it's all big talk. And then they come here and they harass the American conservatives. I mean, there was one, Alicia Kearns, who was like openly talking about how the Republicans should be sidelined and advantage the Democrats. And I'm like, you know, I'm part Yankee, part Irish, so it's like my natural instinct maybe is a little bit, you know, like not.
I can see there's a certain feistiness creeping in here. Yeah. Come on.
So they need more realists. And I actually, to his credit, I think David Lammy is laying out the Labour shadow minister, foreign minister, is laying out a more compatible vision to what people like me are talking about, which is a increase in defense spending, more of a UK focus on Europe. I'd rather have a lot less talk and haranguing and more delivery.
To me, coming into the US after the time that bill was going through Congress, we had, as I say, Dame Cameron Pierce last week on the podcast saying this is existential. That reflects David Cameron's view, which in turn reflects that of the UK government. It seems to me like almost whatever happens, you're saying that there is going to be this disconnect were Donald Trump to return to power. And you think that would not apply so much if Labour were in power. That surprises me.
Yeah, no, it's so existential that when the head of the British Army said that you might need to consider conscription in the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Sunak shut him down. So not only do we have the person who helped cause this problem in David Cameron, but we have the government speaking out of both sides of its mouth. So I concede that the situation in Ukraine is of much more significant interest to Europe. I think Russia is a serious threat, particularly to Eastern NATO, but it would be a little bit more credible. I mean, the polls are going to 4% defense spending, including over a transition of government. Britain is giving us this fake accounting trickery and then yet coming in and harrying us.
You feel harangued? I mean, as far as I understand it,
well,
from
I mean,
the
look
ambassador,
at what David look at what David Cameron has been saying, and any rational person feels harangued. So I think what I'm saying is actually the vision that I'm laying out, and again, I don't speak for anybody, but I think it would resonate, is actually more compatible in some ways with center-left governments, potentially. For instance, governments that want to have more of a European complexion. You know, my view is if the Americans are going to expect the Europeans to do more, well, the Europeans should have more discretion in political issues in their neighborhood. Okay, that's fine.
So you're a fan of David Lammy, in short?
I'm not sure what David Lammy would do.
Not of David Cameron.
I mean, based on what I can see, David Lammy is far preferable to David Cameron. Obviously. I mean, absolutely.
Labour communications, this is one show for you.
David Cameron is like, it's astounding, the intervention into the American system. It's really, talk about foreign interference.
This is the perfect time to take a short pause, and we'll be back in just a moment to hear more from Elbridge Colby about how Trump administration might approach China and the Middle East in a bit more detail after this. Welcome back, everybody. Mr. Colby, you're clearly very worried about the prospect of China posing a military threat to the US and to the Pacific region. It is the subject of your book, The Strategy of Denial. And you've argued this week, indeed, following up on that, that China is by far our most formidable challenger. Thus, any conflict with China would essentially be the decisive one. So all US forces anywhere need to be made available. I did wonder reading that whether you weren't sort of jumping the gun. I mean, why would it be in China's interest to take on the US militarily, jeopardizing economic interests? A quite difficult time for Beijing in the economy. And that's always been the raison d'etre of Chinese foreign policy, is this sense of kind of balance. Why do you think they'd get a rush of blood to the head?
No, that's not true.
You don't agree with me, do you?
How do you think Mao wants civil
war? I feel it's coming.
How did Mao win the civil war? How did they push us back in Korea? This is a myth about the Chinese. They're Clausewitzian. Why would China go to war? Well, it has several very good reasons that are rational and not irrational. One is that it cares very deeply about Taiwan as a part of what Xi Jinping has called the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. And there's no realistic peaceful solution in the near term. And Xi Jinping and Wang Yi and others have specifically reserved the right for military force. Doesn't mean they're going to do it, but they're not going to get Taiwan peacefully. The second is relates to your broader point, which is that what Xi Jinping is saying is that the United States and its allies are strangling China's future economic growth. So my argument is that China, like rising great powers of the past, like, I don't know, Great Britain, has an interest in creating a secure geoeconomic sphere, because China believes that it does not believe that the current international system, frankly, with some justification, is set up for its benefit. It sees what's happening, with even Janet Yellen saying that tariff and non-tariff barriers are going to rise, and even skepticism in economically anemic Europe towards dumping its export factors. And of course, it can secure that. What's a historical analogy? Well, Japan, 1941, when the United States placed oil and tin blockade on the Empire of Japan from position of military weakness. Okay, those are the basic reasons. Xi Jinping has a sense of urgency because of the military balance in Asia, his own personal biological clock. He's a Marxist, so he's not doesn't believe he's immortal, etc. And the formation of an anti-hegemonic coalition that adds to Beijing's fears of being contained and strangled. And so your point is, why would China risk it? Well, as a Brit, you should understand very well that war can pay if you succeed. And as an American, I can say, having spent some time in California and Texas, that war can pay if you're successful. We did not get that peacefully from the Mexicans. You did not build your empire and your secure geoeconomic sphere by being nice to people. That may be how people in the United Kingdom think, but if you go to India, you get a different perspective, right? So war can be very attractive if it's successful. And if you think that you are the attacked party, if you are being, quote unquote, strangled, then you believe that self-defense is permissible. And by the way, that's all logical and deductive, et cetera. Look at what they're doing. What they're doing is an unprecedented military buildup, nuclear breakout, sanction-proofing their economy, and politically conditioning their population for, quote unquote, extreme circumstances. How much warning do we expect to get?
Do you think Europe is in lockstep with the US on approach to China? I'm thinking about the Commission President, European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen. She joined the Maastricht debate co-organized by Politico just a few days ago. And her theme when she's talking about this is that Europe needs to de-risk, not decouple its relationships there with China and where it sits between China and the US. What do you make of von der Leyen's view here?
Well, to answer your question, is the US and Europe perfectly aligned on China? No, and I don't expect it to be. And the visits of people like, I mean, von der Leyen's interesting, but the visits of people like President Macron, Chancellor Scholz, and others to Beijing is very revealing. The European economies have taken a big hit. China and the US share an interest in China not becoming the preeminent global power, but Europe is a weaker power. Its economy is doing more poorly. It faces a more immediate threat from Russia. Moreover, the fundamental fact, I think this is important, is that Europe is not that significant in the determination of whether or not China ends up as regional hegemon in Asia. Why? Europe does, ultimately what matters is military forces relevant to the theater, because economic sanctions don't work very well, apropos of our point about Rob Greenway. And Europe doesn't have, it's not 1937, Europe doesn't have military forces relevant to the theater. Moreover, economic sanctions, A, I don't think are going to be very significant. They're not really working against Russia. So an economy 10 times the size of Russia, that's far more important to the global economy. You know, you have to really be skeptical about economic sanctions having an impact. And moreover, important point, the Chinese are preparing for the imposition of those sanctions and stockpiling food, energy, all kinds of other things that suggest they are prepared for it. And by the way, it's a Leninist dictatorship. They went through the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution in living memory. Do we really think that we're going to sanction them? And our sanctions never, they've not, I mean, Cuba is still run by a communist government. It's a tiny little island off the coast of Florida. So the main thing is, I don't think we should give Europe too much. I mean, look, Europe should de-risk for its own reasons, because you don't want all of your stuff to be controlled by Huawei or TikTok or whatever. But I don't think there's some kind of deal where Europe's like, oh, we're not going to de-risk if you don't support Ukraine. Because A, I would take that deal anyway, if that's what you want to do, because I don't think it's going to matter that much. And B, I think you're going to de-risk anyway, because it makes more sense.
I just have one challenge. We could just deal with this briefly if we could.
Yeah.
There are those on the right who disagree quite profoundly with your view, and particularly on the grounds that a Cold War approach, said William Ruger, prominent foreign policy realist, would harm American interests better handled by a Goldilocks strategy. Could be right, couldn't he?
Well, I mean, I don't have a theological. I think my difference with someone like Will, as a good friend, is we need to have a strong military along the first island chain to be able to balance China. I'm not nearly as sanguine as Will is about the organic balancing by Asian states, because China's so much stronger. So the tendencies for what's called bandwagoning were going to be much greater. The other critique I get from the right is, you know, we can just decouple. The problem is, if we look at the Japan example again, is that if we aggress, I support decoupling. And, you know, if President Trump and Ambassador Lighthizer wanted to pursue a decoupling course, I would support that. But we must be militarily ready, because that presents us with a 1941 situation. And if China dominates Asia, it will not allow us to reindustrialize and decouple.
Spinning the globe to the troubled region of the Middle East, and particularly looking at the state of the conflict in Gaza, how do you think a potential Donald Trump 2.0 would handle the situation in Gaza if it's still unresolved by the beginning of next year?
Well, I don't know what President Trump would do. I know he's spoken a bit about it. I don't know if he's talked specifically about Gaza too much. But, you know, I think Republicans in general will be generally strongly supportive of Israel. So I think probably a more supportive position would be that, you know, towards Israel would be the natural instinct. But not to say that, of course, you know, Republican presidents in the past have had different views than the Israeli government, of course. So exactly how that would net out. I think the big point that I'm making, I don't pretend to know how to fix this very difficult and tragic situation, is that the United States cannot afford to get enmeshed in another large Middle Eastern war. I mean, that would be a disaster for us.
Let's not forget the confrontation between Israel and Iran 2 weeks ago, which looks to have simmered down a bit for now, but could easily break out again. Israel, America, others too have pointed the finger at Tehran for its sponsorship of Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Houthis in the Red Sea. Do you think the Iranian regime is on a footing for a major war? And there's also been quite a lot of focus from supporters and foreign policy allies of Donald Trump for being much, much tougher on Iran. Where do you stand on that?
Well, whether they're on a war footing or not, I don't know. Others can probably say more. I mean, my impression is from reading the press and so forth that actually Iran is not keen on, you know, getting itself in a major war at this point. And its behavior in response to the Israeli strikes, for instance, suggests that as well, that they're carefully calibrating. I mean, obviously, they're up to no good in terms of supporting proxies and other things. But that's my impression. That could change. That may be time bound. That may be a tactical decision. I don't know.
But let's imagine you were in a position where you were, I know you will say, you know, that you don't speak for the administration and everything's on the, you know, yet in the stars as to who will be closely advising Donald Trump, if indeed he, you know, was very uncertain, but if he were to return to the White House. That idea of a preemptive strike to degrade nuclear facilities prepared and being deepened, as we know from intelligence sources, by Tehran, that is going to be a major decision to have to make. Which way would you be advising him?
Well, I just, as I said before, I oppose the Iranians getting a nuclear weapon, but I don't think we cannot afford at this point to get enmeshed in a large Middle Eastern war. I think we can support our allies a lot, and that's where revamping our defense industrial base, which we're not doing sufficiently, would help on that. But I think strategically and politically, it would be a big mistake to get enmeshed in another large Middle Eastern war.
I think the range of this conversation has just certainly brought to my mind, and I hope to our listeners, the extraordinary complexity of decisions that lie ahead. I wonder, perhaps with that in mind, who you would like to hear us talk to somewhere down the line on Power Play. Put them in the hot seat that you've been friendly enough to join us in today.
Thank you. Yeah, I would recommend Kevin Roberts, the head of the Heritage Foundation. I think Kevin is one of the real leaders in where the party is going and understanding that perspective, which I think is very important for audiences, not only in the United States, but also in Europe.
Great. Clear answer. Clear booking. Always very good, because then you get to do our booking work for us. We hope you'll add us to your playlist too. Elbridge Colby, thank you for coming on Power Play.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That's all for this week's edition of Power Play. We hope you enjoy our transatlantic conversation and do keep listening. Next week, we'll be heading to the Pacific Coast to talk to movers and shakers at the Milken Institute Global Conference in California. We'd be grateful if you'd give us a review, and most importantly, please do follow us on whichever platform you get your podcasts. I would be extremely grateful. And so would the team behind this podcast: Peter Snowden, senior producer in London, executive producer Christina Gonzalez, and thank you to Mike Chan in New York City for his assistance. I'm Anne McElvoy. Thanks for listening.